Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Happy Wednesday. As always, it is such a joy to be back here, to be in the countryside. If you need to talk, if you can just talk quietly. Maybe say it in Russian. The subjects that I'm going to talk about over the next couple of days are all, I feel, very important, because I don't know about you, but from last year to this year, particularly after November the 8th, I feel we've been on a bit of a roller coaster. You know, when you're watching the news and every day there's just, you can't remotely keep up with it, because there is so much going on, be it in the political world, be it in the world news. You know, they've got this Mishigana out in North Korea who seems to be determined to show the world that he exists. I mean, who ever heard of North Korea before? And it's scary. We're living in a world which is running so quickly. And one of the great joys of coming to camp, I honestly feel this, and I've felt this for the last 15 years, is that you can slow down a bit. That, okay, you won't listen to every news broadcast, you won't read the newspaper. I mean, I don't mind reading the newspapers, of course. But, you know, you take it a bit slower because you need time to assimilate. You need time to think about what's going on. And I think that's important. That's an important process which I don't believe many people, particularly people who use Twitter accounts, and without referring to anyone in specific, they don't seem to have a sense, give you a sense of thinking it through. Okay, and I'm just saying that as a kind of introduction, because I think the subject today is really, really important. I've thought about this a lot. You know, coming to camp where we have a population, and this has been true in Camp Block and here as well, a population that knows what prejudice is all about, has experienced prejudice firsthand, and be it, you know, through events leading up to World War II, through that period, or be it post-World War, people living in the United States, you know, you still see pictures from the 50s and 60s where there was a big sign on the golf club, no Jews, no dogs, and no whatever. So, you know, it's been here, and prejudice is around. They just yesterday arrested, or I think they arrested, a guy who was drawing swastikas in concrete outside a building which was known to be built by somebody Jewish in Brooklyn. And he was drawing swastikas, idiot. I mean, he was being photographed by CCTV. I mean, it blows the mind how stupid people are. But nevertheless, you say to yourself, what is that all about? Why is this coming back again? What is prejudice? What does it mean? What does it represent? And more to the point, and this is what I'm really concerned with, is as Jews, do we have any allowance whatsoever to be prejudicial? And Jews, unfortunately, I mean, I'm going to talk about my parents' generation. There were certain words that were used when one described certain members of society, which nowadays are what we would call politically incorrect. Somebody told me they just watched Blazing Saddles after 30 years. Mel Brooks got away with absolute murders in that film in terms of political incorrectness. And it's almost embarrassing to watch the film today, because the amount of pejoratives that he's using about different groups in society, you know, including the Indians speaking Yiddish and all the rest of it, is just beyond belief. I mean, it is funny, but you think about it, the world has changed. And maybe for the better, maybe. But what I really want to talk about, essentially, is from a Jewish perspective, do we in any sense have permission in any situation to be prejudicial? Or are we, when we look in our sources, this is what I really try to do, to check the source material, right? I'm not talking about ideas, and I just don't want to hit you with philosophical ideas, but I want to look in our sources. Go back to the Bible, the Talmud, let's see what the rabbis said about this. Because when we find out what they say about it, it really is quite revealing, eye-opening, and to be perfectly honest, it is something for us to think about. Let me just preface a little bit more by talking about certain issues today which really worry me. I work in Columbia University, and those have been reading a bit of the press around Columbia and other universities. You've come across something called BDS, divestment from Israel, which is unfortunately, seems to be a very big cover for a lot of what we would call today anti-Semitic comments that people want to make. Call it anti-Israel, but essentially it's anti-Jewish. And it's disturbing because so many Jews, particularly young Jewish students, are being caught up in this. And they don't have the ammunition, they don't have the material to be able to fight it. They seem to feel that the thing that you should do is protest Israel. Everything that Israel does, look at what Nikki Haley, this wonderful lady, if you know who she is, the new representative in the United Nations, finally called them out on one of their committees, which spends all its time criticizing Israel. And she said, what is this? This is a place where we're supposed to deal with what's going on around the world. And every day we're only talking about Israel. The one place where you can behave and live like a free person, and all the other countries which you should be criticizing and should be saying that there are problems, you don't talk about. Don't talk about what's going on in North Korea, in China, in the Arab world, and everywhere else. It's unbelievable. And she's called them out on it. And good luck to her, because she's fighting a very difficult battle there. Let's just define the words, because I want to make sure we understand. What does prejudice mean? Prejudice, I again looked it up in the dictionary, prejudge. That means that before you have the information to hand, you're already prejudging what you're going to say. All right, and we do this sometimes. Unfortunately, people do it about us. My wife has got a story when she was working in the hospital in London. She wore one of the, a shaitel, but some sort of head covering. And one of the other nurses wasn't Jewish. When she found out who she was and she said, oh, you're Jewish. Oh, that's interesting. You must be very rich. That was the comment. Wow, you know, halavai, I wish it was true. And when we had this discussion, you know, she said, this is what I've been told. And it wasn't prejudicial the way she said it, but clearly whoever had said it to her somewhere along the line, it was made up an opinion without really, you know, look at the statistics, how many Jews are really wealthy, how many Jews are really living below the breadline. There are many, many more on the breadline than off the breadline, let's put it that way. We know this, but unfortunately these comments are bandied around, and it's a problem. We say it sometimes in our own world. We talk about neighborhoods being bad neighborhoods. Do we really know if this is a bad neighborhood? I know, my parents, when they got married, they had an apartment in the equivalent of the Lower East Side in London. I wish they would have held on to that apartment. Today, in the year 2017, the apartment's worth $1 million. Lower East Side, who would have thought? I mean, it's just crazy. But at the time, the comment was, it's a bad neighborhood. So they moved, like all the good Jews, they moved to the suburbs, as they did in this country. So, you know, we use this language in terms of prejudging. We are, obviously, in a situation, once we do have all the facts, then we are in a situation of no longer prejudice, but of possible discrimination. In other words, if we feel that, if we feel that a certain comment is justified based on the facts, then, of course, we can justify to say that, you know, under certain circumstances, certain situations, it is a bad neighborhood. I went to the police and I checked how much crime is going on, etc. This is not the place for me. But that's not prejudicial. That's already based on knowledge. That's based on understanding of the circumstance. Prejudice is what I'm talking about here, of making up ideas, making up your mind before you really know what is the reality. And where the Torah deals with this, which is so interesting, and it's a bit of a wow, 36 times in the Bible, 36 times. Now, anyone who studied in a Bible class will know, the Torah does not repeat things more, maybe once or twice, for emphasis. 36 times. 36 times. And it's talking about someone called the Ger. Now, the Ger, we normally understand, the Ger in Hebrew normally is translated as the convert, right? Person who converts to become Jewish. But it's clear from the Bible, when it's talking about the Ger in the Bible, it's not talking about a convert. And I'll tell you why. I'll just read the verse to you. It says, "V'ger lo toneh, v'lo tilchatzenu." Do not oppress the ger, I'm leaving the word in Hebrew for the moment. Ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. For you were gers in Egypt. You weren't converts in Egypt. We didn't convert to Egyptian religion. Quite the opposite. We stayed Jewish. So it can't mean converts in the sense of what it means today. And all the rabbis are perplexed by this word, and the consensus is that it means the stranger. Ger means do not, oppress the stranger. And there's verses, it's in Shemot, it's in Exodus, and Vayikra, and it's in Devarim. It repeats itself, as I said, 36 times. Don't afflict the stranger. And of course, the question then is, who are they talking about? What is the Bible talking about in terms of the stranger? If this is a code for the Jews moving into Eretz Israel, and the Jews had literally sort of conquered the land, then what strangers are we actually referring to that are living amongst the Jewish people? One tribe had a piece of land by the coast, the other one had a piece of land in the middle. Yehuda was around Jerusalem. What strangers are we really talking about? And this is, again, one of the questions the rabbis deal with. And they answer, and they say, you know what? What we're talking about is not a stranger in the sense of someone that we don't know, but it's someone who is in a vulnerable situation. Right? Now listen to this. This is a quote from the Sefer Chinuch, the book of Mitzvot, and the reason for this mitzvah. And I'll just read it to you a little bit in Hebrew, but I'll explain. He says, Shoshei mitzvah, what is this mitzvah? He said, Milvad masha katamnu, kedei lakof et yitzreinu l'olam, leval na'aseh kol asher nimtza b'kocheinu la'asot l'ra'ah. We are being told that there are vulnerable people in society. People, sometimes they're just vulnerable, they're just weaker. Right? And of course the Torah makes a point of telling us who are the vulnerable ones in society. Sometimes it's the widow, sometimes it's the orphan. You know, we go through all of these different definitions, but we understand people in certain circumstances, and nowadays of course many people are vulnerable for all different reasons. You know, in terms of maybe their living circumstance, who knows? You know, sometimes we find ourselves in very difficult situations and we feel vulnerable. We are told, as a society, says the Sefer Chinuch, 12th century Spanish rabbi, he says, his hartanu bezeh, ha'ish, the man is warned here, God warns us, shehu beinenu b'li ozev somech, that if there's someone who has not got some sort of support system amongst us, who is very vulnerable, basically, we must not take advantage of that vulnerable person. So what did I think of when I read this? Of the stories of sweatshops. And, you know, my rabbi in London always told me that his father, who was a tailor in London, the same story I heard in New York many times, from Shabbos to Shabbos, they would have to get a new job because they wouldn't work on Saturday. So they were told on Friday afternoon, you're leaving for Shabbos, come back, don't come back next week. And they had to go to another sweatshop. And usually the owners, unfortunately, were Jewish. And it's one of those things where the society, once the vulnerable elements in society are not being taken care of, that's when the Torah kicks in 36 times. And it's saying to us, don't take advantage of such a person. Don't be, the word we're going to use, prejudicial. Don't assume because that person is different, is weaker, is not part of us, not part of the group. Therefore, it gives me permission to believe what I want to believe. We're getting into Nazi Germany. Look what they started believing about Jews. And this is how dangerous this whole thing becomes when people not only are vulnerable, but also are made vulnerable. And, you know, we don't have to even go through the history. I don't have to explain to you because I think everybody here understands. But what a revelation. It's not about the convert anymore, but it's about the person in society who is vulnerable. And I'll tell you something interesting. My father-in-law, and my parents, my mother was still alive. My father-in-law moved to Israel 10 years ago. And for the last few years of his life, he wasn't very well. He was a professor of computers, very brilliant man. And never, as soon as he gave up work, his mind began to wander. He just couldn't focus anymore. Eventually, my mother-in-law, in desperation, took in what they do in Israel. They take in what is called Filipino. Filipino is someone usually from the Philippines or from Vietnam or somewhere like that. Many, many foreign workers who are being moving to Israel. There's a better life for them in Israel. Interesting thing, literally thousands of people there. And he, this gentleman was brought in, and thank God he looked after my father-in-law till one day when unfortunately he got very sick, and then really that was the end. And in Israel, I read a number of years ago, and this is still an ongoing thing, they have a problem that the Filipino in Israel is not a protected group, meaning that some people are taking advantage of them. Some people are talking about maybe we should expatriate, we should send them away. Sounds like a bit of what's happening in this country as well when we hear some of the news. Should we keep certain elements in the country? Should we not? The Filipinos were not being accused of crimes. It wasn't a criminal element that was coming into Israel. That's not the group that we're talking about. This is a group that essentially was being brought in as external workers. I don't know if there's a word for it. People who would come in, particularly in the health and care facilities, and provide the necessary workers that you needed. And it's a problem. And part of the discussion, interestingly, in Israel was about this discussion of the ger lo toneh, you should not afflict this stranger. People were saying that as a Jewish society, we can set a different standard to the rest of the world. The rest of the world will say, you haven't got the papers, you're out. The Jewish society should be saying, you know, what are your values? What are you contributing to us? What are you doing for us that we can recognize and give you a place in this society? And it's an ongoing discussion. It's still happening today. It's still ongoing. We know, and this is again so true, that this is kind of inbred in, I would say, the Jewish psyche. That when there is a cause to be stood up for, who is in the front line of the cause? The Jews. And this is so true in America. Go back to the 60s, go back to I'm talking about maybe the Soviet Union campaign, but before that, the civil rights campaigns, and so many Jews, not necessarily religious Jews, these are just people who felt that this was such an injustice, what was going on, and what was happening, that something had to be done. And the famous stories in Mississippi and various other places, there's no surprise about that, because what I'm trying to say to you is, it's part of who we are as Jews, that we should care for the weaker person in the society. It's not talking about Jews amongst us who are weak, that as well, but it's even talking about people who are living amongst us in our society that we get involved with, that we should be caring or at least be concerned about, and certainly not to be derogatory or, in the worst case scenario, to abuse the system and produce situations which we know have happened in the past. That's the word ger, and it came to me when I did this research. It was a bit of a surprise. In fact, there's a very interesting sort of sidebar on this whole discussion. What is the status of the Arab in Israel today? Can we argue that the Arab has a place in Israel? We're talking about Arabs who want to be in Israel. And believe me, there's a lot of Arabs who want to be in Israel because they know what's going on across the border. They don't want to be there. They want to be in Israel. For lots of reasons, go to any mall. I was in Israel in the Hanukkah time, and the mall is full of as many Arabs as one can tell. The women dressed in Arab dress as much as Jews. It was amazing. No question in my mind, a lot of them want to be there. But then the question we ask ourselves is, what would be, according to Jewish law, if we're talking about going back to Jewish sources, what would be their status? And Rabbi Cook, the famous chief rabbi of Israel, the first chief rabbi of Palestine, in fact, who died in 1935, he wrote about it. And he said there is a concept in the Torah called ger toshav. Doesn't mean a convert. It means someone, ger, who's living, toshav, as a resident in Israel. Such a person, if they commit themselves to keeping the seven Noahide laws, which are very, really, laws of society, don't murder, don't steal, what we would nowadays say, be a mensch, behave like a mensch. Right, you know, have courts, make sure that you run your society according to the law of the land. A lot of very sensible laws. In such a situation, that person has a right, and we have an obligation to respect that right of the person to live in Eretz Israel. It's a bit of a shock, because it's not that there's two populations. One which has the right to Israel, if we go back to sort of religious discussion about this. The fact is the Arab also has a right to live in Eretz Israel, but he's got to obey the rules, I would argue, as much as the Jew has to obey the rules. The Torah says, you're going to misbehave in Israel, you're out. So, you know, there is a sort of quid pro quo here. What is so interesting This midrashic comment that, in fact, I don't know how much of this even to say over to you because it's kind of incredible. In terms of our language, the way we speak about people who are, let's say, not Jewish in our society, all right, I always find that the use of the term goy always upsets me a lot. It's goyish. It's not. It's one of those words which we use, and you know, we want to use it in a sort of descriptive way, but sometimes it becomes, want of a better word, prejudicial. And we have to be careful. And just to give you one example here of how careful we are, there is a law in the Torah called Ona'at Devarim. Not only are you not allowed to cheat a person in money, you're not allowed to say bad things about them, to cheat them with words. There's a whole bunch of descriptions about it. So for instance, the Gemara says this, and I'll give you the example. Ketzad, the Gemara says, what is an example of saying something bad in words? Im haya bal tshuva. Let's say somebody is now more observant than they used to be. Just as an example, but it can apply in other cases. Al yomala, don't say to this person, zechor ma'asecha rishonim. Remember what you used to do. You know, once upon a time, you used to go to the mall on Shabbat, and you used to do this, and you went to the ball game. Don't remind them of that, because that now is something clearly that they've changed. Respect their new life. Im haya ben gerim, if a person is a son of converts, and he knows that his parents were originally, once upon a time, non-Jewish, and had a different lifestyle. Al yomala, don't say to him, zechor ma'aseh avotecha, think about what your grandfather used to do. Im hayager uva l'lmod Torah, and even if someone is coming to study Torah, lo yomala, pa pesha chal neveilod, you'll start making derogatory comments. How can you study Torah? You ate non-kosher food. You want to now say the words of God with the same mouth? This, the Talmud says, is unacceptable language. It's really important to hear. I mean, I read this and I thought, wow, this is so important to understand. When it comes to the way that we interact with the world, be it the Jewish world, and I'm now saying with the stranger amongst us, however you want to define that, I always think of a barber that I had in Manhattan. Gentleman, I don't know, Mr. O'Reilly, wonderful barber. And one day I'm sitting in the chair, and I said to him, I said, Mr. O'Reilly, where do you live? He says, in New York. I said, where in New York? He says, Borough Park. I said, excuse me? And he says, and I'm the only guy left in Borough Park. This is what he said to me. He put it like that. It was funny. And I said, you're kidding me. I said, do you like the stones, everybody? He says, that was years ago. He said, now they've all got clocks and time. Forget about that. He doesn't do that anymore. It was great. It was wonderful. The reality is, you know, how do we relate to that person within our society? Now, clearly in Israel, this is a very serious, serious discussion. Where we live outside Israel, all right, we live in neighborhoods which I guess we can define loosely, so maybe even sort of, you know, more as Jewish neighborhoods, some more, some less. It's usually defined in terms of a religious population or number of synagogues or whatever. But the reality of it is, there's something we should be aware of. That, and this is to me the big deal, that once we are, as it were, presenting ourselves as Jews to the world, that all of a sudden an obligation, a responsibility falls on our shoulders. People have the expectation that we will behave, or we will speak, or we will conduct ourselves in the correct manner. And it goes on, that there are endless, I don't want to go through all of these references, because there's just so much. Wow. Non-Jews come to the Jewish court, and they say they want to have their own courts in Israel. They want to judge according to their laws in Israel. Are they allowed to? Rambam says, yeah, we've got to give them basic rights of respectful conduct. If they want to say to us that with all due respect to the biblical law, we want to conduct ourselves according to our law, say the Maimonides writes, yeah, you're allowed to facilitate that particular request. We know that when it comes to charitable activity, are you supposed to support the non-Jewish charity? And the answer is yes. May not be your priority number one, and we all know how many letters we get through the mail almost on a daily basis of Jewish charities, but you know what? When you've got that extra, you know, sort of the Christmas time or whatever, and they knock on the door, so you also give them a few bucks, because believe me, it is so appreciated. And it's not just an appreciation, it's an awareness that we are seen to be caring for the world around us. And I think this is so important. My favorite story, and you probably heard this from me before, was the philanthropist in England called Isaac Wilson, very wealthy man. And he gave a lot of money. Thank God he gave to Jewish institutions, but mainly to colleges. And one day he was being recognized by Oxford University. And he was being given a degree, an honorary degree. So people asked him, what was the degree in? So he said, it's in writing. So they said, Sir Isaac, he was a sir. Sir Isaac, you write? You know, are you an author? He says, no, I write checks, he said. He got a degree. And, you know, that's, again, recognized, and it's important. And many, many Jews do this. Go to any hospital in New York or even around the country. We were just connected a little bit in Philadelphia to see there. The number of philanthropists that have given money to hospitals who obviously are from the Jewish community is just endless. And thank God. And the reality of it is this is all part of what we are commanded to do, to care for the people around us. Now, I'm saying ger, meaning the person who is in more vulnerable, but it applies obviously in a wider sense, that we should be seen to be caring for, you know, the society around us. And clearly prejudice has no place in this discussion. So much so that there is a famous statement of the Talmud, Omar Kroos, the Gemara in Ketubot, page 33, Mishpat Echad, the Torah says, there'll be one law for all of you, Mishpat HaShaveh L'Kulechem. You're not supposed to discriminate. When the judge sees two people walk in the door, one person's in shmatas, the other person's just come in, you know, as they say in England, he came in a Rolls Royce, and he came in such a fancy car, whatever. The judge does not say, well, I'll take the rich guy first, and the other guy, he can wait. Whoever is there, the line is the line, the person is the person. Discrimination is unacceptable. And so on. Of course, nowadays, very interesting part of this research, and this is where I got a bit carried away, is the term of the use black, the description in Talmudic literature. Listen to this. Fascinating. It says about... I've forgotten which character. Shaul, King Saul. His name was Shaul ben Kish, right? His father's name was Kish. And the rabbis play on the word, and they name Saul, they talk about him using the word Kush. Kush ben Yimini. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, and the name that they use him is the word Kush. The word Kush is a Hebrew word, which Kushi means someone who is black or from Ethiopia or whatever. That's usually the idea. So the rabbis are perplexed. Why is Saul called given the name Kush? So listen to this. Shaul Shemo, the Gemara says, my Katan, page 16, it says, his name was Saul. Elama Kushi Meshuneba Oro. Just as the person who has a dark skin has a different skin, Av Shaul Meshuneba Masav, Shaul is also very unique in the way that he behaved. Kiyotsei Badavata Omer, a similar description, where it talks about Isha Kushit Ashelokach, Moses married a Kushite woman, and that's a description of the wife of Moshe. We read it a few weeks ago. And the Gemara asked, was she Kushite? Was she black? No, she was a Midianite. She wasn't from Ethiopia. It says her name was Tzipora. We know her name. But again, the Gemara says, Kushit Meshunah Ba'ora, just as there is a difference in terms of her look, Af Tzipora Meshunah Ba'maser, Tzipora was also very different the way she behaved. She was a tzedekus. And it goes on, and it talks about the use of the term Kush that we find in the Bible, with the other characters in the Bible. We read a Haftarah a few weeks ago, Halo Kibenei Kushiyim Atem, the Jews are considered like Kushiyim, like blacks, meaning that this is a symbol of beauty, a symbol of recognition. And I just got to add, and again, next time you're in Israel, if you haven't done this already, if you ever come across any of the Ethiopians who have made Aliyah, there is something so bechent, I can't begin to describe it, in terms of the look of the Ethiopian Jew who has come to live in Israel. It's just something special. In fact, so much so, one of my students told me she's leaving early this semester, a few years ago. And her brother's getting married in Israel, so very nice, mazal tov. Who's he marrying? And she's from Maryland, right? You know, sort of very mainstream, I would say. And she told me her brother's marrying an Ethiopian girl. And I did a wow. I said, this is a wonderful thing. I said, you're going to that wedding on one condition, right? My condition is you bring back photos, because I've got to see this picture. It's something unique, it's something special. And it's happening in Israel, and there is a recognition of chen. There is a certain beauty, a certain charm, which I just can't even begin. I can't put it in words, but it is very special. So what I'm trying to show you, and there are other sources as well, that the term, to use the term black, is never, or has never in traditional Jewish sources, been a term, a derogatory term. On the contrary, it's been something which has always been used essentially as a term, a description of being different, but in the positive sense, of being something special, of being something which we should admire when we are put in a situation to admire it. It after all of this, and we can see that we're pretty anti-prejudice, there's no question in terms of what we've been saying, is there any place where we should act in a prejudicial way? And there's only one place that I found that it might seem prejudicial and nevertheless be encouraged, and that's in terms of a law in the Torah which affected King David. King David was descended from Ruth, and we know the story that Ruth was a convert. She was from the Moabite world, and the rabbis have a big problem with this because the Torah says Moabites are not allowed to be converts. So how could Ruth become Jewish? And the rabbis say, well, if you look at the Bible, it said male Moabites cannot be Jewish, but females can. It was a what they call a Gezerat HaKatuv, or whatever, the special learning of the verses in the Torah, and it was accepted, except it wasn't. David had to fight about this his whole life. There were some people in the world at the time when David was living that claimed that he wasn't Jewish. How could he be king of Israel? He's not even Jewish. And this was a constant battle that David had. Just want to finish this point, and then you'll see where I'm going with this. In the biblical description of why the male Moabites cannot become Jewish, the rabbis explain, in fact the Torah explains, because they didn't treat you well when you were asking them for help. You were on the in the desert coming towards Eretz Yisrael. We read again a few weeks ago. And when you went to them to ask for a bit of food, a bit of water, some sustenance, they pushed you away. They did not come out with bread, they did not come out with water. They were not in any way there to help you. They were so negative. In which case, the rabbis explain that the Moabite is not acceptable in the Jewish world, not because he's a Moabite, but because he exhibits characteristics which are absolutely against everything that we stand for as Jews. As Jews, we stand for chesed, for kindness, doesn't matter who it is. Guy comes to the door, the guy comes and pitches his tent in front of you and he needs help, you help him. When Shlomo Carlebach died, the famous rabbi, at his funeral there were half a dozen people, maybe more, who you would only describe as people who sleep on park benches in New York. What are they doing at Shlomo Carlebach's funeral? He's an Orthodox rabbi. And they said this was the rabbi that we all loved. Why? Because he just helped us unconditionally. He would have an envelope, someone gave him money, wouldn't even open the envelope, he gave it away immediately. Some say he had an envelope once, $10,000 in the envelope, somebody needed money, he gave him the envelope, didn't even open it. This was something I can't describe to you, but at his funeral they turned up. These men who normally one would have very little to do with, you know, the best of times, and they came to the funeral because they heard that the rabbi had died. Remarkable. And all I'm saying is that if there is any room for any sort of prejudice, it may be that in terms of people who represent ideals or values which are against us, this is not against the person, it's against the values, then we can basically, as a society, maybe turn around, this is something which may happen in Israel one day, and say this type of person who represents this type of value is something that we can exclude from our society. It may be one day that, you know, sort of the Hamas, who, for far as I'm concerned, they were just another news item today, talking about how much longer Gaza can survive under Hamas. Not much longer, apparently. It's a pretty dire situation there. When they get help from whatever charity they're getting help from, the money seems to end up in Switzerland and not in Gaza. And this has unfortunately been going on now for a long time. The reality of it is that would be, let's say, someone representing that type of philosophy, we would be, I guess what I'm saying is, and this is something which is found in the sources, be allowed to be what is called prejudicial. But that would be, let's use a better word, discriminatory. If we know the facts and we understand where that person is coming from, then I would like to think that such a person we would have trouble maybe we would have to discriminate against such a person if that was the situation. Obviously, if the person is coming to reform and to become a different, as you see, sometimes you see these cases of people who have reformed and are now sort of very upset with the way that they have behaved in the past, that's a different discussion, that's a different story. But that's the only area I found remotely where any sort of prejudicial behavior would be considered, right? But when I look through any of the other sources, not there. It really isn't. It's so unacceptable to look down at the society around us in a prejudicial way. Again, I don't think I have to make more comments from the sources. I mean, we could go through it. I missed out half of what I wrote here because it just goes over and over and over again. And I hope the point is made. We have a problem, and I'm just going to finish with this point, then I'll take questions. The problem I'm always struggling with, particularly in the religious world, is what I call being judgmental. And it upsets me that today, because of the particularly the dress code that exists in the religious world, the black pants, the white shirt, the hat and everything else, if you don't fit the dress code, then all of a sudden you'll start finding people who maybe won't relate to you in certain neighborhoods, and they'll become prejudicial. And without knowing anything about you, without knowing what you are, what sort of person are you, a good person, are you about chesed, do you do kindness, and they just don't want to know. And that is something which I would argue in the Jewish world is unacceptable. Dress codes, I don't care. Wear whatever you want. But don't become judgmental because of that. Because that, to me, is wrong. We, as Jews, are the last people in the world to be prejudicial. Look how much we've suffered from prejudice. We are certainly the last people in the world to be judgmental. Look how judgmental people are towards us, have been and still are. And anti-Semitism is rearing its ugly head yet again all over the world. Doesn't seem to go away. It's an evil that we just cannot get rid of. So for us, the message has to be, the more that they come against us, the more that we have to be positive towards the world as much as we can. Do I go and embrace the anti-Semite? No, because he won't want to embrace me anyway. But do I show the anti-Semite that as a Jew I care for the world and I'm not the stereotype that he wants to make me out to be? If I do that, then maybe I'm going a little bit towards fighting that evil which is coming up around us. Are Jews allowed to be prejudicial? The answer is a categorical no. FS. Absolutely not. I'll leave you to think about this because I was very excited about this research. It really is something to read. Any questions? Any comments? Because I know it's a bit hot out here and we're all kind of wilting a little bit. So I wanted to make the series more topical because prejudice is something that you only switch on the TV and you hear some prejudicial comments and all different. Just as Jews, we should know where we stand. Tomorrow, I want to talk about cheating and honesty because that's another issue which is really disturbing at the moment. In various communities, there have been situations where people have been called out over very serious infractions of local law, of federal law. What are we going to say as Jews? You probably know what I'm going to say, but it has to be said. So please, God, tomorrow, I'll try and make sure maybe the time will be a bit different. I don't want to clash with the other lecturer, but thank you for listening. Thank you. Yes, question?
We've been at the brunt of attacks for these centuries.
Yes.
So, we're sort of not immune to fighting back. Self-preservation,
but not by being prejudicial. That's what I would argue. Being prejudicial is not the way to fight back. To fight back by showing who we really are. What do we really stand for? Israel is a phenomenal Kiddush Hashem in the world. Look what they're doing in Israel. It's amazing.
I'm talking about prejudice against people who are very anti-Semitic.
That's the only area where I said, like with the Moabite, the original law in the Torah, there would be an allowance.
This woman
who is really shocking, is shocking.
BDS movement.
And at the beginning, if you heard what I said, I started off with the BDS. That's what I said right at the beginning. Because that worries me. Because I see the attacks on Israel particularly. I'm not saying Israel is perfect in everything they do. Nobody says that. But for Jew to be so against everything, you say the word Israel and they already start going on a tirade against you without finding out the facts, we're not finding out what is the real truth, as much as you can, that is very upsetting.
I'll give you an example of what happened with me one time. I was doing an audit he went out of Harlem development.
Yeah.
And one of the Nazi personnel there would take tenants. It was up, it happened in 1964.
Right.
And it was Johnson running against Goldwater.
Goldwater, right.
So this fellow, the black the officer, he says to me, I bet you you're a Goldwater man. So it was the last thing in my mind to vote for Goldwater.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I said to him, I says, yes, I am. I says, you know why? He says to me, why? I said, because in your little mind you want me to be. And the other black friend started to laugh because this guy didn't know what to say.
Yeah, yeah, that was very, you said the point. Yeah, no, it's just, it's a comment which was relevant to the discussion about how to deal with prejudice in certain situations. You've got to use a bit of seichel. I don't think to go with like JDL, to go with fists was the way to go, with all due respect to Meir Kahana, Zichro Livracha. Sometimes we have to. In Israel, for sure, we have to defend ourselves. But in this country, I hope there are other ways to deal with the problem.
I've heard about these universities, not just your school, but throughout the whole
United States. So the whole United States.
Is progress being made now? Well, I mean, I've heard that a young woman was on the radio the other night. She said progress is being made.
Yeah.
But I wonder how much. How fast?
There is a group in Colombia now, supporters of Israel, basically trying to engage BDS movement in some sort of dialogue. So at least we're talking to that element to exchange ideas, so at least to find out what are you saying. And of course the biggest thing, which is still the most incredible thing, is to bring them to Israel. If you can bring anyone to Israel who is so anti, and just see for yourself. My wife had an Egyptian doctor just now. She was in the hospital for a short period. He comes in one day with a little machine. He says, Egyptian doctor. He says, you know where this machine is made? He says, in Israel. Isn't it amazing? And that says everything. He understood what Israel is contributing in the world of medicine. And no, on the contrary, only admiration. And that it's a slow process, but I think it's the only real way to go.
But, do you feel that we're making progress?
In Colombia, a little bit, yeah. Yeah, I really do. But slowly, slowly, slowly. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm sorry it was so warm. Tomorrow, if it's not going to be here, then it'll be inside. We'll see how it goes. Thank you, everybody. And just in time. Just in time.
Just in time.